Labor and Consumer Affairs. And first on our agenda committee, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2160. This is a bill that we had sent out to the floor, and we're going to bring it back to get some further clarification regarding the bill and answer some questions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holby, I can't read my script here.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2160.
Representative Holby moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2160. We passed 2160 to the floor on February 4th. I asked that it be brought back to committee before the floor debate so the committee would be part of a discussion between Representative Richardson and the Insurance Division regarding borrowing on the life insurance policies and annuities. Is there any objection to Representative Holby's motion? Seeing none, to suspend the rules. Seeing none, Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2160.
Representative Holby moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2160. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2160 is back before the committee. And Janet, can you very quickly explain to us what we're doing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2160 was an insurance division bill that made a number of changes. It clarified that insurance companies could issue more than one class of insurance in a package insurance policy, and clarified that an insurance company may permit the holder of an individual annuity policy or a pure endowment policy to borrow on the policy. And if you have the bill, the area in question is on page 3 of the bill about the amount that can be borrowed, and it's up to equal the cash surrender value of the policy. That's the you'll see that in line 7 on page 3. And the loan value is talked about also under subsection 5 on that page. Mr. Chair, the bill also deleted a requirement that DCBS publish an annual report of its official transactions because that information is available as other sources. And, Mr. Chair, there was a letter that we routed to your offices yesterday to Representative Richardson from the Insurance Division that covered some of the issues under discussion.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Richardson, please. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Richardson. I'm state representative for District 4, and I come before this committee not as an expert but as a concerned citizen. In the late 1970s, actually, it's the early 1970s, I was a licensed insurance agent, and I did work with insurance and annuity policies. And in the 1980s, for several years, my primary emphasis in my law practice was estate planning. And so my information is not current, but my ability to read and review certain aspects of this bill, I think, relate to whether or not it would be appropriate for it to go forward. I have no opinion on any aspects of the bill other than the two that Ms. Atkins has referred to. I would like to begin with the wording that is found in the bill, and I'm going to page 3 of the bill, subsection 5, and the wording says, for the record, as follows. Except as provided in ORS 743187, if the total indebtedness of the policy, including interest due or accrued, equals or exceeds the amount of the loan value of the policy shall terminate and become void upon 30 days' notice by the insurer, mailed to the last known address of the insured. Now, if you go to the beginning of section 5, it says, an insurer may advance a policy loan equal to or less than the loan value of an annuity policy or a pure endowment policy. And so originally this section was about whether or not loans should be able to be made on policies, pure endowment policies or annuity policies. The subsection gives to an insurer the automatic unilateral right to terminate a policy if a policyholder takes a loan out on that policy. And that's even if the loan interest is being paid. I'm not sure which policies they're specifically relating to, but my understanding of endowment policies are that quite often an endowment policy or a pure endowment policy is like a single payment annuity with insurance in it. And so I did contact a very experienced current licensed provider of insurance and annuities, and I asked the question, with this kind of wording, could there ever be a time when a policy would have value even though there's been borrowing that has been made on that policy? And he said, well, certainly there could be. And so if that's the case, and since we represent constituents, if there could be a policyholder that would have his policy terminated merely because he borrowed against it, then this is not a good provision to pass into law. It's favoring insurance companies because it gives them the unilateral right to terminate a policy that may be of value to a policyholder who may no longer be insurable. And so I think that this, regardless of what else happens in the bill, this provision is not appropriate. Now, we did receive, and you received a copy of a February 10th letter. I have no dog in this fight other than as a concerned citizen, but I find it somewhat interesting that in this letter, all of the discussion of this provision refers to annuities, and there's no discussion of the effect it might have on pure endowment policies, and yet this provision applies to both. And so I'm not sure why I wouldn't get a straightforward letter that would deal with both possibilities, but since that hasn't been included in the information that we've been provided, then I think that we should assume that in a close call, a decision should be made in favor of the insureds and not the insurance carrier. Second item is the very last sentence of this bill. It merely says, Section 8, ORS 731.272 is repealed. That looks fairly innocuous, and I understand that it may not have been given in the course of your debate and hearings on this bill in the past, that may not have been discussed what that provision really means. I have arranged through the assistance of Katie Howard to have handed to you a copy of that provision, which is being asked to be repealed. Notice it says that the director will be giving annual reports. I would direct your attention to the parts of these reports. You know, one that says, you know, who's insured with, what insurance companies are licensed in Oregon and so forth. But subparagraph 4 says that the agency is to provide to the legislature annually a statement of operating expenses of the Department of Consumer and Business Services under the insurance code, including salaries, transportation, communication, printing, office supplies, fixed charges, and miscellaneous expenses. And then subparagraph 5 says, we want a detailed statement of monies, fees, taxes received by the department under the insurance code, and from what source. Now, we know that as a legislature, we're being looked at very closely for possible conflicts of interest. We have to have full disclosure because of the influence that we have over what laws are passed and what laws aren't passed. Well, if you're the insurance commissioner in that department, and you've got well-funded insurance companies whose very livelihoods, as far as selling policies in Oregon, are controlled by members of this department, there could be a tendency or a temptation to help assure that there may be certain perks. And I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I'm just saying that there's the inherent possibility, because of the power this department has over the insurance industry, that they could receive things, opportunities that might be worth disclosing to the general public. Or there could be, and I'm not saying this would ever happen, but there could be times when some member of the department might have a vendetta against an insurer or an insurance company and could take certain actions that would be detrimental to the business of insurance in Oregon of that insurance company. And so how do we assure that doesn't happen? Well, a wise legislature in years past says every year we want a full disclosure of all the income that's coming in and all the expenditures that are going out so that there can be clear and complete disclosure. Now, the agency says, we don't need this anymore because this information is all on the Internet. That's what I was told when they came to visit me. Yet, I noticed that in their letter that they gave to us, it says in subparagraph 4, which is toward the bottom of page 2, it says, regarding a statement of operating expenses of the Department of Consumer and Business Services under the insurance code, including salaries, transportation, communications, printing, office expenses, fixed charges, and miscellaneous expenses, their response is, we are in the process of putting this information on our website. Well, in the process could mean it's a twinkle in the eye, or it could mean that it's going to be up and running tomorrow. All I know is I was told all this information is available on the website presently, and yet that wasn't the truth. And one of the most important provisions has information that is not on the website. And even if it were, it's like going to DHS website. You think you can just find anything you want when there is a huge amount of data that's being presented? I'm saying that by merely having this type of vital information somewhere buried in a website does not mean that there's going to be oversight by the legislature, the representatives of the people, to assure that there aren't abuses or opportunities for abuses taking place. For those reasons, I believe that these two provisions, at least, should be taken out. And since there hasn't been full disclosure and discussion of these things, you might possibly consider having this bill go over till next session. I certainly would leave that to your judgment and discretion. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Looks like you. Thank you, Representative.
May I be released to go back to my other...
Certainly. Joe Ario, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the administrator of the insurance division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Let me start by saying that the issues that Representative Richardson raised this morning are a little different than the issues we've discussed with him in the past, and we haven't had a chance to review these particular comments with him, and I'd be happy to do that. I still think it can be worked out. We did try in our letter to address the specific issues he raised at that time, but I will offer a couple of general comments in response to what he said. On the annuity and endowment provision, the loan provisions in policies are not the primary purpose of those policies. Those policies are intended to be long-term vehicles, and the loan provisions are only there for the convenience of a consumer who may get in trouble. But anybody who buys those kind of policies with the notion that they want to borrow against them is making a foolish choice in the marketplace. They ought to have savings accounts or other short-term vehicles. So this is very much a sidelight to the policy, and then in that respect, the industry does put some penalties on the loan provisions in these kind of policies. It doesn't help the consumer financially when they do have to borrow against these policies. What he describes as in this law is what is currently in policies. What we're trying to do in this bill is clarify current practice, current approval. Nothing that is in this bill would violate current law. So were we to change it in the way that Representative Richardson suggests, there would be two consequences. One, insurance companies probably wouldn't offer some of these products in Oregon because we would have a different law than every other state on those products. And two, if they were going to offer them, they would reprice them so that people who took these loans and weren't going to have the same consequences as they have currently would essentially get a new benefit, but it would be charged against everybody else's policy. So I understand his points. You could change the rules here. The legislature certainly has the ability to change those rules, but those would be the two consequences: the fewer products available, and also higher prices for everybody else to the extent the products were available. We can get into this more with him, and I think we can explain all that further with him if you'd like. But those would be my comments on that one. On the annual report, the letter does say in the process. I just checked with my staff aide here. here who says that's because we were doing it that day. It's now up on the web. So this material, there were a couple technical parts of point four that weren't on the web page, and now everything is on that web page. I can tell you the annual report, the last time we published one in hard copy, there were 40 people who received it in total. We did a survey before we proposed this bill, being very careful about these sorts of things. Not one of those 40 people said that they considered it important to have a continue to receive a hard copy, and several of them thanked us for telling that the information was available more quickly and more readily and in real time on our webpage. So we thought this was a kind of easy, straightforward thing to say, instead of producing an annual report which comes out months after the fact, and by the time it comes out the information is not current anymore, we would instead have it all on our webpage, or a couple of details we didn't have on our webpage. We've got that clarified now, and so I think it's, again, in the nature of regulatory streamlining to have used the web page to communicate in real time to people, especially when not a single person who received it had an objection to that. So that'd be the statement. We'd be fine to work with Representative Richardson if the committee wants to hold the bill and do that, or if the committee wants to report it out, that's fine with us too. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Schoenfler.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope you do square away with the representative, because in the spirit of his I take the spirit of his testimony. Representative Richardson and I have our disagreements, but he was making a pretty good case today. And what I really want to know is, why are only 40 of these reports created, and who gets them, and why aren't they more widely distributed in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoenfler, again, it's in conjunction with our efforts to save the state time and resources that are available to anybody who requests them in hard copy. We do have a system now where we send out notices on what's available on our webpage, and have found over time that the vast, vast majority of our constituents prefer to get the information in real time over the web, not just this annual report, but other reports. But we always offer anybody who wants a hard copy that. I'll give you an example from our agency that doesn't come from my division but comes from OSHA. A few years ago, somebody in that division made the suggestion that instead of sending full copies of their rule proposals to everybody on their list, they ought to send a notice saying there are some new rules available. You can get them on the webpage, or you can get a hard copy. It's your choice. And that proposal was adopted, and the savings to OSHA on that was something over $200,000 a year, because it turns out most people accept the electronic version. But clearly, anybody who wants the annual report in hard copy, we'd be willing to say, we'd pull it off our webpage, print it, and send it to people. It would be cheaper than the process we currently use.
Yeah, don't send me one. But is it a diverse group of people that get it, or your constituents? Just for my information, who are your 40 constituents? Just give me your...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoenfler, I'd have to get back to you on the specific details. My guess is, for these kind of reports, it's people inside the insurance industry who are looking at their competitors. That's primarily who would look at this kind of data in that way. And again, most of the people that responded said, we don't use this anymore. We look at your webpage on a current basis.
Thank you.
I believe there wasn't anybody on that list that would qualify as sort of an outside consumer type person. It was it's the industry that's the audience for this.
So people within the industry, the local insurance agent or insurance company, the people are going to be requesting this type of information?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. By and large, the people who are trying to keep this close an eye on the specifics of the insurance industry are the people who are within it, and they're looking at what their competitors are doing, that sort of thing. But I can get the list. We have the list of who received it, and I'd be happy to provide it to the committee.
Thanks.
Too.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Mr. Arie, I think what's important also is that if people want to know, if somebody decides they want to investigate these things, that they can and they know where to go. And I was certainly under the impression that all of that information was already on the web, and I took it as kind of an act of faith when I voted on this bill. But I guess what would be important moving forward is that we make sure that the annual report is there online, all of the information in one place, as opposed to having to poke around and look for different parts of it. So if you're saying that it's we're going to have an annual report, it'll say annual report here, click here, and a PDF file will come up with the same things that that you've sent out in the past, I'd be interested in moving forward with that. If you're going to have to poke around and look at six or seven different places, that's a little troubling to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, I think that's an excellent point. I hope that's the way it's up there today. If it's not, we'll make sure that it is the way it's up there, because it should be available in one click of a button called annual report. And again, I didn't look at it myself, so I can't verify today that it is, but we will make sure that that's the way it's posted. I think it's. I totally agree with your point.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Joel. I do have a question about this bill. If, in fact, we were to repeal this section on annual reports, with the idea that this information is available on the web, is there any place in this bill or in any other statute that will require you to provide these annual reports on the web?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hovey, no, there would not be. We will post it. We post a lot more information than this. If it would help the committee here to have a mandate for us to post this particular information, we would have no problem with that. The only thing I would point out is that if you were to try to pass a law that sort of dictated each of the things that's on the web, you'd end up with a fairly big bill. So singling this one out would I'm not sure you want to do that, but if you do, we're going to post it, so we have no problem with that kind of mandate.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you would not be opposed to being mandated to either post it on the web or provide a hard copy to someone who requested to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, yes. Our common practice is that if people want hard copies of something that we have on our web page, we provide them. I will tell you that the only exception I've seen in my 10 years in the business is sometimes insurance agents want us to give them hundreds of copies of some of our educational materials in hard copy, and sometimes we don't do that for them. We will do it for an individual consumer. We will do a copy for anybody, but generally we will always provide that kind of information.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? I see. We're in a work session. This is invited, isn't it? I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2160, and the committee will stand at ease just for a couple minutes as we went to get Representative Richardson.
Anderson.
Yeah. Public hearing on House Bill 2369. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am, for the record, Representative Gordon Anderson, representing District 3 in Josephine County, Grants Pass. I'm coming before you today to reach back 2 years. We had a discussion over 2 years ago in the 2003-2005 session where one of my constituents, who is a fire sprinkler installer or fitter, came to me and felt that there was a need for licensure in this specific skill. During the last 2 years, there's been quite a bit of information brought together by a task force that was working both by the contractor side and the fitter's side, and I think we've gained quite a good understanding of some of the needs. The thing that kicked it off for me was that I heard the rather tragic circumstance that a fire station in Madras had gone through fitting and had their whole new fire sprinkler system placed in, and within, I think it was in the first few months, it fell down off the ceiling and damaged some of the fire trucks. Not good installation. And that was what kind of stimulated in me the thinking that we need to look at the whole licensure problem for fire sprinkler fitters and then also the contractors for whom they work. I have had the pleasure of meeting with a number of the folks on both sides. I think they both have contributed quite a bit, and very strong information that's brought into the discussion both on both sides. I'm hoping, it was my hope, that we would in some way be able to stimulate education and training in many different areas, and I think that has occurred. There are there's the ability for fitters to be educated in a number of different areas and create a supply for the contractors to pick from and to choose the people that they would like to hire and work. But I'm going to turn it over to those who have participated in the discussion. I think you'll have a lively discussion and an informative discussion as to the situation of where the problem has been and where they are now. So thank you for the opportunity to come and introduce this possible legislation.
Thank you, Representative. Would you like to, I can open a hearing on 2428 also, if you'd like to make comments on that.
Same comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think they relate to both bills, and it might be good to have the hearing on both at the same time, but my comments would remain the same.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative, any questions, Representative? Thank you again, Representative, for coming in this morning. Could I have these parallel?
Yeah. It's the same. No, it's the same.
Okay. Janet, I'll ask you, can you, I neglected you, do a summation on this bill for us.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2369, would require the Department of Consumer and Business Services to create a licensing program for fire protection sprinkler contractors by January 1st, 2007. And it defines a fire sprinkler contractor as a person who designs a sprinkler system or who supervises the installation, maintenance, inspection, testing, or repair of such a system. After January 1st, 2008, it would require a contractor to be licensed, bonded, and insured in order to to do any of those activities. It authorizes DCBS to set the qualifications and fees by administrative rule, and there is an exemption in the bill for a person that has two or more years of fire sprinkler contractor experience by January 1st, 2007. They would be exempt from the bonding and insurance requirements. Finally, Mr. Chair, the bill allows municipalities that are authorized to enforce building codes to enforce provisions of the new law and to investigate violations. There is a penalty provision as well. And, Mr. Chair, its other bill, House Bill 2428, the next bill on the agenda, that would create a licensing and actually an apprenticeship requirement for the installers themselves. So 2369 is about the business or the supervision, the contractor, and the other bill is about the individual installer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Amanda Rich. Yeah, Ken, please come on.
Good Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today. I'm with Western Advocates, and we actually represent a number of clients that are interested in this issue. And I helped to coordinate the task force over the interim that you heard Representative Anderson talk about. And it is that task force that brings you these bills. There are a number of folks in the audience today that participated in that task force. It consisted of fire service representatives of the sprinkler industry, both from the fitter and contractor side, and also representatives of the fire protection engineers, and a number of folks who care very deeply about the standards and public safety and protection in this industry. And Ken, did you want to talk, or you want me to just continue? Okay. As the representative mentioned, we are in the midst of a work group process on these bills. There are a number of stakeholders that are implicated or that are touched by these bills, and we're trying to work out technical aspects to make sure we're not regulating people who don't need to be regulated, and that we're also achieving a level of public safety that the goal that we're trying to reach here with these bills. The one thing that the work group does completely agree upon is that there is a problem to be addressed here. And I've handed out some information to you, the yellow packets here. And the statement of the problem that I've laid out there starts out with the fact that we are increasingly relying on sprinkler systems for fire protection in Oregon and in fact throughout the nation, but particularly in Oregon. We adopted a new building code last October, became effective this January, that increases reliance on sprinkler systems and in fact creates a trade-off between passive fire protection and the active fire protection of sprinkler systems. So we're going to have buildings that are indeed protected by a sprinkler system but aren't going to have those passive mechanisms in place either. So it's going to be even more important that the sprinkler system works when it's called upon. In addition, NFPA code has changed in response to the Rhode Island tragedy that I'm sure you all heard about, where 100 people died in the nightclub, and they have changed their occupancy requirements for those types of public assembly places down from 300 to 100 in terms of when you need to have a sprinkler system. So we've got codes that are coming together to place increased reliance on these systems. In Oregon, we've done a look at the state fire marshal statistics on fire incidents, and it has become clear to us through an analysis of those statistics that up to about 10% of the systems, when called upon to work in Oregon, are not working for some reason or another. So out of about 2,000 fires that happened between 1999 and 2004 in which there were sprinkler systems in the building, about 10% didn't work for some reason or another. And the entire work group agrees that that's just not acceptable. When we walk into this building or any other building that's sprinkled, some of us may notice the ceiling or we may not, but there are sprinkler heads up there. And if we notice them, I think we probably think, great. You know, this is a protected building, and we expect those to work. But we don't get to test that. We don't get to know whether it's going to work until they're called upon. And you know, we switch on the lights. We know the electric's working. We turn on the water. We know the water's flowing. We don't know that the sprinkler system is working. And we just count on the fact that it's going to. And we're seeing a disturbing pattern that may not be working the way that they're expected to. Studies show that sprinkler systems will work when they're properly installed and properly maintained. Code requires that they be inspected regularly, and it's necessary for skilled individuals to be doing that inspection and that testing we can ensure that the systems are working properly and that they're going to work when they're called upon. Right now, and I'm sure this is This is pretty basic. It's why we're bringing these bills. But right now, there are no standards in Oregon that require either an installer or a contractor show a level of competency in order to work in the business. For a contractor, you need to be licensed with CCB, but there are no specific industry requirements that you have to show that you're skilled at all in the art of fire protection. And for the installer as well, there are no requirements in order to work as a person hanging sprinkler systems. There, I've listed a number of anecdotal stories that we've heard. These have come from fire marshals around the state. Other, we hear the stories come throughout. I've pointed out three on your list. We had a situation in a Beaverton school, the Madras Fire Station. You heard from Representative Anderson, and then most recently Rex Putnam High School in Clackamas County. They did a retrofit on their system, did a retrofit of their high school in order to put in a sprinkler system, and it was done in such a way that the sprinkler system will not operate because of the way they installed the ceiling tiles. Also, just heard this morning about an assisted living center in John Day where the sprinkler system didn't work properly and doused a few individuals while they were sleeping. Very quickly, I guess what I would just close with here is that we're working on this. We've got a work group together. On the third page of the yellow packet that I've given you, I've listed off the members of the work group. We all agree that there's a problem. As we hear a lot in this building, the devil is in the details, and we're working very hard to come up with agreement on the details. And we hope to bring to you a solution. We're really close on the contractor bill, and we're having continued discussions on the fitter bill. And we really hope we can bring you some bills that you will look upon favorably so that we don't go another 2 years without this important public safety legislation.
Thank you, Amanda. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. And Amanda, this isn't just for you. It's for anybody out here that's going to be on this nice group of nice people. You know, I'm all for, especially in public buildings, working, inspected, functional sprinklers, and I'd rather be doused in my bed than burned in my bed. But, you know, this exemption idea, you know, in other areas we've ran into big problems. And if we do the exemption, and I'm sure there's qualified people out there doing a good job applying these that we can trust, I'm no doubt in my mind. But if we do the exemption, the very people in your anecdotal evidence are going to be exempt. Now, those are the folks we don't want installing. So, you know, so this exemption idea, I have a problem with that. I really do. I think people need to be qualified. They need to be licensed. They need to prove their quality. Right now, under the law, I understand, with my contractor's license, I can go and install these things. Now, I'd never do that. But I could, and you wouldn't want me. Actually, I'd probably do a pretty darn good job, but my point is, I don't like the idea of exempting the very people that brought this issue to us in the first place. That's my main concern right there.
Representative Escobar.
I'd like to add a footnote to this, too, because if you install something, I want to know what that building is to avoid it, sir.
I just replumbed my house.
No. No, he's quite capable contractor. I love to tease him. My concern here, and I've discussed this with her, is I think that it's great that we do license people. I don't have a problem with that. But what my concern here is that we're not really talking about the real problem. The real problem is who inspected these buildings? Who inspected these sprinkler systems? Where are the people at Putnam High School that inspected that signed off on it? Did we discipline them? Probably not. Madras, you say it was a fire station? For heaven's sake, people, you're the fireman. I mean, am I missing something here? What are we paying inspectors for? You either have a county inspector, you have a municipal inspector, or you have a fire marshal. Somebody signs off on this for an occupancy permit. Why have we not addressed that?
If I may speak to that, Chair Brown, Representative Escoval. There is a task force that met over the interim between the Fire Marshal's Office and Building Codes Division and a number of other interested parties that are trying to address that very issue of the level of expertise that is necessary to inspect these systems. The technology in this area has absolutely just ballooned over the last years, and so we're trying to address that issue as well in terms of level of competency for sending in plans, reviewing plans, providing inspections. And I guess the other issue that I would point out is that as the law stands today, in an area where the fire marshal has jurisdiction for inspecting the building, that inspection doesn't happen until the absolute end of construction. And yes, they are catching these things and they're red tagging them, but it's not until the very end of construction. It was a fire marshal on a routine inspection that found the Rex Putnam high school problem. And I guess what we're trying to address here is that the appropriate time when this should be found? At the end of construction, when you're going to have to go in and rip out a system that somebody has invested in? Or is there some way that without onerous regulation that we can say, let's put a good product into the system, have good inspections, and get our desired result of operational systems? You put garbage in, no matter how many inspections you have, you're going to get garbage out occasionally. And inspections are not going to solve this entire problem. There just is not enough manpower out there, and there's not enough eyes. So we'd really like to get good product in at the beginning of the system, good installation, and good maintenance, and good repair. But absolutely, we are addressing the inspection issue. But it just doesn't require legislation.
Ken, why don't you go ahead and then we'll ask some more questions.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. Ken Armstrong. I represent the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters, and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, one of the co-requesters of this bill, along with the district directors. And I really want to echo what Amanda has said. This is an issue that, as you've already been able to tell by the questions, is a systemic issue. It is something that requires at the table the people who install these, the contractors, the fire service, and bring everyone to the table to make sure that we're moving forward in a direction that ultimately the objective is we want to make sure that this one thing that is proven to be the most effective mechanism for saving life and property is done properly. And all the questions that have been raised, Representative Schaffler, Representative Escobel, that you raised this morning are issues that we are talking about in this work group, and we met as recently as yesterday. We're working through this. I think we're getting very close to being able to bring to you a package that's going to do exactly what we need it to do, and most importantly is going to be of most benefit to the people of the state of Oregon. So with that, certainly be available for questions, but we do continue to work hard to make this product be tighter and ready for your final consideration.
Any other questions? Representative Escobar?
No.
More? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Could we have Sean Miller, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors. And with the Chair's permission, I know I signed up for both of the bills, 2428 and 2369. I think they were portrayed to you in a package, so I'll just do my testimony on both of them this time. Thank you. Jeff Dean, who is with ABC, has been participating in the work group, and we will continue to participate in the work group. I think one of the fundamental differences in the two bills is we support some higher standards. We do agree, and I want to state for the record, we do agree that higher standards on the industry should be initiated by the legislature. and we're supportive of that. House Bill 2369, which is the contractor bill, which is actually putting the responsibility on the contractor as opposed to the bidder, we are supportive of working out some higher standards on the contractor. We do feel that that ultimately it is the contractor who is responsible for the performance of his or her employees. We also believe that the life safety issues that involve in the installation of the system ultimately lie on the contractor, because the contractor is responsible for the design of that system as well as the selection of the fire protection devices. And so, you know, some of the examples that Amanda illustrated, we agree with. We want some higher standards in the industry, but again, it's the contractor is responsible for that, and we would be supportive of working on that bill and not House Bill 2428, which is the just licensing of all the sprinkler fitters. And that's, I think, where that's the only difference we have in the work group. And so, again, we would like to bring back a package as a work group to the committee, recognizing Representative Schaffler and Representative Esquivel's questions on inspection. I think there's ideas that could be brought out on third-party inspections. As you're building the project before it's completed, where you hire an expert to come in and make sure that the project's done to the standards that are expected of the industry and the contractor is expecting to do. I think those are the two checks and balances that would make this the higher standards and make an effective package of bills for this session. So those are the two things. Item, again, contractor, higher standards, and on some of the inspection process. And we don't feel at this time that on the fitter portion of the bill is actually needed. But, again, we're participating in the process and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thanks.
David Taylor, please.
My name is David Taylor. I'm a professional engineer and member of the Board of Engineering Examiners for the State of Oregon. And basically, the Board of Engineering Examiners has reviewed this Bill 2369. And with the exceptions and changes in wording, we support the certification or registration of sprinkler installers. There's some wording in the bill there that we find that doesn't meet the needs of the engineering profession, probably, and the safety of the public. Specifically, we see in there the first page of the bill, item 2A, refers to the planning and design of the sprinkler systems. We would like to see that wording struck from the bill, because the planning and design is an engineering function. It is not a contracting and a installation, maintenance, or operation of the sprinkler system.
Can I ask Mr. Kale a question?
Yes, Representative Schaffler.
You mean, sir, that my contractor's license doesn't give me the qualification to be an engineer? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that's right.
I wanted to clarify that. I agree with you, too.
Okay. The engineers are registered.
Which section were you referring to?
Yeah. I have here under bill for an act, and then there's a section 1, a section 2, fire protection sprinkler contractor means a person who, for compensation or with the intent to be compensated, arranges.
I don't have it. You're on 2369?
Yeah, section 2.
Section 2369.
Section 1.
Section 1.
Section
1.
Two. Yeah. Section 1, paragraph 2A.
Okay.
What this does is that it opens up the entire gamut of engineering design for any system, for a high-rise, multi-story building to the contractor, and it takes it allows him to bypass the engineering process. And the engineering process is meant to assure the public safety requirements are met. Review of the codes, the standards that govern fire protection. I heard here from Representative Esquivel the need for inspection of the installation. The post-installation inspection is probably one of the most important items in the process. There are a number of steps within the process of designing a fire protection system, including the hydraulic design, the layout, the fuel loading, the building, the zone type applications, and these really take into go beyond what the normal installer, the contractor, would take into consideration in the designs there. And it also puts a third party in there, the person doing the design, and that says that the contractor has to install the building, that bids the contractor has to install the system as designed. Then if you have the post installation inspection, there's a number of workarounds that contractors will do which will affect the actual operation of a system. And they go out there and they find that all of a sudden there's a heating duct that was put in a location where the sprinkler system goes, and they start working around it, and they've just added some hydraulic length to that and reduced the carrying capacity of that particular pipe. So if the post-inspection determines that the pipe did not have the carrying capability for the zone that it was designed for, then they have to make a workaround, go back and make it work. So we see that there's some problems in there of opening the entire gamut of design to the installers. The other area that we look at is the exemption for engineering. I find a problem there in that it does exempt a person registered as an engineer under ORS 672090. Well, ORS 672090 just empowers the board to issue a license. It does not describe the process by which or define engineering. We would like to see that probably to define the range of the definitions of engineering and the practice of engineering, so that it would should be read to include 672.002 through 672.092. And that would pretty much cover the area of exemption there in engineering. And that would take care of one of these other problems, this other problem about planning and design. Currently, buildings with under 4,000 square feet are exempted from engineering design requirements. Buildings over 4,000 square feet are required to have an engineer, structural engineer, an engineer do the design work on the building, engineer or architect. Architects falling under there's common exemptions between engineering and architecture. And so we'd like to see the exemptions for engineering at least be clarified there to include the whole broad range of definitions through practice. The part of the issue, I think, I heard about what the Madras Fire Station there comes into competency and to for a lack of standard of care. And if that was an engineered system, the board would take upon complaints filed with the board against the engineer, we would look at undertake an investigation and look into his practices to see that he was performing to the current standard of care. We would be looking for a negligence, gross negligence, and it may go from a reprimand on up to revocation of the license. So we have some controls there that we would like to continue with. If you strike the planning and design right now, from this particular bill, the codes and the practices within the building code division meet that need. I attended a meeting last summer of the National Council of Engineering Examiners, and one of the key issues there was fire protection. And we had a statement that that came out that was unanimously passed by all of the states, recommending that the authorities having jurisdiction utilize the codes that are built into the National Fire Protection Codes there to assure that all of the elements of a fire protection system are met, and that the proper stamps, when the engineer does his work, he stamps his work, and he personally takes responsibility for that work. It becomes a legal document at that point. And so he can be held responsible for any of the inadequacies, and typically adequacies. Nobody ever finds out about adequacies. It's failures that we find out about. But the authorities, it recommended the authorities having jurisdiction, which are the permitting agencies, utilize the engineering profession, and even the inspectors within the fire protection agents, the permitting agencies, hire people as qualified in fire protection inspection. It's a whole different animal, I guess you could say, than some of the other engineering, because of the codes involved and the complexity in the codes. And that's why we say remove the design and the planning of the systems from there and handle it with the existing procedures for design and engineering.
Representative Schulter.
Thank you. I agree with you. This is kind of unrelated, so it has to do with another subject. But over the years, the liability insurance has went up. Has engineers' liability insurance went up as well?
It has.
Right.
I think another key player in this whole issue here are the insurance and the rating agencies that actually insure the buildings, and they want the best engineered system that they can to protect their investment within the building. They don't want failures. It costs them out of their pocketbook. So there's an economic reason to do that. And I think you'll find the insurance agencies, companies, supporting proper engineering design. Professional life, I did high-pressure natural gas engineering. And we had certain requirements for high-rise buildings, for buildings of public assembly, for buildings with limited egress, which would include hospitals, jails in there, nursing homes. And we had buildings which contained hazardous materials. And then you have the seismic requirements. And all of these have to be involved in the design of a proper fire protection system. So I can't say strongly enough that the building, that this bill probably meets the needs of the construction and the installation part of it, but it probably is a little bit lacking on the definition for engineering and allows the design by the contractors and installers, which the sheet that I handed out is a statement by the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, that is working with the board, and we have determined that the hydraulic calculations for sprinkler systems is, in fact, the practice of engineering under the definition of engineering. There are a lot of programs out there that you can that technicians can use to do equivalent calculations, and probably the same engineer will use those calculations, but it's the interpretation and it's the application of the data from that that designs the system. So we would like to see the design removed from that part.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Okay. May I make a comment on the other bill, too, on the bidder bill?
I'm going to open the hearing in just a minute on that, then, okay?
Okay.
Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on House Bill 2369? Yes, sir. Come on up, please.
Good morning, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. My name is Kenneth Fugley. I live at 15814 Northeast Rose Parkway in Portland, Oregon. I am an Oregon registered fire protection engineer with 10 years in private practice. I'm here today as a private fire protection engineer who's familiar with the issues through my personal experience and through meetings and discussions with both contractors, owners, and with the state board. While I support the concept to prescribe minimum qualifications for sprinkler system designers, I believe some changes are very necessary. I believe an engineer must be involved in complex systems and systems for certain hazards and certain occupancies where the public safety is at risk. My prior experience, I think, gives me a unique perspective on this. I have 7 years' experience as a firefighter and as a deputy fire marshal with Tualatin Fire District, Corvallis City, and with the State Fire Marshal's Office as a temporary employee. I have about 7 years' experience as a sprinkler system designer working for contractors in Oregon and nearby states. I have about 8 years' experience working for mechanical engineering firms. So I've seen this from all sides. We know that the record of sprinkler systems is very good, and the industry will tell you that. It's important to note that much of that record was developed at a time when nearly all the plans were reviewed by engineers with the insurance rating bureaus. So corrections were made if there were errors in layout or calculations. And as a designer, I know that happened a lot. Also, here in Oregon, we had excellent people at the state level that reviewed plans through the Building Codes Division. They have NICET, or National Institution for the Certification in Engineering Technologies, 4 levels of technicians. And they define technicians as members of the engineering team who work under the supervision of an engineer, scientist, or technologist. They have a policy statement that opposes any effort to misrepresent them as qualifying to do engineering. Also, the Society of Fire Protection Engineers in 1998 prepared a white paper which defined differences in the scope of duties and between engineers and technicians. They're in the process of revising that white paper to clarify it and bring it more in line with the recent policy statement of the National Council of State Boards. There are some conflicts with the current bill in that it would almost give sprinkler contractors freedom to design without any involvement of engineers. I think that there should be rules set up with input from the engineering board, the current proposal, Consumer and Business Services, State Fire Marshal, and Building Codes Division, because we do need to raise the qualifications of designers, but we need to keep engineers involved. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, sir, for testifying. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2369? Well, close the public hearing on House Bill 2369 and open the hearing on House Bill 2428. Amanda Rich. Ken, did you want to come up at the same time this time, too? No. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning again, Representative Brown, members of the committee, Chair Brown. I guess I really could just say ditto to the last testimony. We believe the clients that I represent believe that licensing the individual who performs the installations of these systems is an important part of the entire public safety package that we're trying to formulate here. As you heard from Sean Miller with ABC, there are some differences that we're trying to work out, and there's always concerns raised when you're talking about licensing individuals, and we are we're working on trying to smooth that out. So that is an issue being addressed. If I may take a second to address the issue that was brought to you by the engineers, I'd like to point out on the list of work group members that the American Council of Engineering Companies is represented. Marshall Koba, who many of you probably know from around the building, represents them on the work group, and we actually specifically discussed the design issue yesterday and have an amendment for House Bill 2369 that will address the issue of design. We did not intend to infringe upon their jurisdiction, and nor did we intend to not completely exempt them. Whatever exemption language is necessary for that bill, we'll make sure it's in there. So just wanted to answer that question, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Amanda. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you again for your testimony. Sean Miller? Sean must have left. This is Mr. Taylor, David Taylor. Do you want to testify on this one, too?
I'm not representing the board in this testimony, but just a personal private citizen. But as I see, this is a union bill, and the route through the certification of fitters here really comes through the union apprenticeship. And I know there's a lot of areas in the state of Oregon that do not have access to the union apprenticeship program. And I'm wondering how this bill then would affect people in areas that are not accessible to the apprenticeship programs to enter and to get a certification as a fitter. I think that this basically parrots the union apprenticeship program, but if it were put into a more generic format and allowed union programs to proceed on with their programs, but there also be other routes to become certified as a sprinkler system fitter, I think that would be more appropriate, and it would open it up to more people. And we can encourage, what we really want to do is encourage competency at all levels, at the engineering, at the installation, at the fitter level.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Any questions? Thank you, sir, again for your testimony today. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2428? I have Darren Parsons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the board. Darren Parsons, and I am the union business rep for the majority of the state of Oregon. just a rebuttal. This is something that we've been working on for a couple of years. All the way along, have invited all parties to these work groups. There are several apprenticeship programs recognized in the state of Oregon. The federal program is a correspondence course. Apprenticeship, historically, is an on-the-job learning experience. It's supplemented with academic requirements. Our program is a correspondence course. The other two apprenticeship programs are not union apprenticeship programs in the state of Oregon. All are recognized. This isn't a union bill. This is a bill, and both bills are basically trying to improve the reliability and the quality of installation of these systems. For the most part, they're installed properly. They're maintained properly. We're trying to raise the bar and eliminate the areas where that isn't done. Not everything can be caught by the inspectors that are doing the final look at these products. The engineering is great. The design is great. We still need a minimum level of competency by the people that are installing those. We need to know that they can read the drawings, can identify the different materials, and that they are installed per that drawing. There is a great deal of responsibility on the contractors. All we're looking for in the fitter bill is to demonstrate a minimum level of competency, and we're trying to work with Oregon Building Codes to get there. Thank you. Any questions?
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, I wish it was a union bill, but to address Mr. Tail's concerns, someone in the far reaches of the state can currently do correspondence work to get this level of competency, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 24 or 28? Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2428. And, committee, I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills. Janet, we had one. Is it?
Good day. Your place this morning should be LC 2435 at the request of Paul Romaine.
The chair would entertain a motion to introduce the...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move the committee vote in the affirmative introduce LC 2435 as a committee bill.
Representative Kitts moves that we introduce LC 2435 as a committee bill. Is there any objections? Is there any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
It's fine to introduce it as committee bill. I do not like the bill.
So noted. Is there any objection?
I've read the bill. How'd you read it that fast? How'd you read it that fast? I just discovered it.
What do we got, super legislator over there?
A letter at your place today regarding House Bill 2076. It came in after the hearing on that bill. It has to do with home inspectors, and we're entering it into the record, and you can put it in your bill file. It supports the bill that we have installed and not moved.
Can you do that? Can you enter stuff into the record after the fact, after we've had the public hearing?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The chairman can do anything he wants.
Do you concur with that, sir?
It is part of the public record now. We've discussed it.
That's right. Oh, you got me on that one.
Chair, you may be talking at the next meeting about a date for a meeting in Portland and a tour. And the date we're looking at is currently is March 11th, or 18th as a backup, I guess. And that's a Friday. It would be in the morning. You may either be late to your afternoon committees or they, I don't know, most of you have, about four of you have an afternoon committee.
I do.
I tried to check with their administrators to see if they were meeting that day, and no one knew for sure. But you may be able to be back by early afternoon.
All right.
On the road.
Do you have afternoon meetings?
I do. Last about an hour.
Where in Portland?
The apprenticeship facility.
Up there in Portland.
Would you prefer that?
I'm going to skip the tour.
I've already been on it.
Is there anything else? Don't see anything. We are here.
After we tour, will we consider